Thank you for tuning in to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your guest host, Jim Swift, and we're joined today by Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, author of Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Thanks for joining us, Senator.
Thank you, Jim, and thanks very much for your interest in Sacred Duty.
Well, the first question I have for you, Senator, is what was the impetus behind writing your book?
Jim, I wrote Sacred Duty because I've been able to tell over the last few years that Arlington holds a very special place in the hearts of our fellow Americans. I knew when I served there that it was a special time in my life, but it really wasn't until I got into public life that I realized just how much it means to so many of our fellow citizens. So in 2012, when I was introducing myself to Arkansans in my first congressional race, I found that the question I got asked most about my life was not Iraq or Afghanistan. It was about Arlington and my time with the Old Guard. And likewise, now when Arkansans come to visit me in Washington, they often will build in a few days to see the sites, and I will ask them what their favorite stop has been, and they almost always say Arlington National Cemetery. It's just happened to me late last week. Yet the story of the Old Guard, the infantry regiment that performs military honor funerals in the cemetery and guards the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, has never been told in full. It is told in passing, you know, or you see glimpses of them in social media, as we did this past weekend over Memorial Day. But there's never been a book that really tells the story of America's regiment. And I think it's a great story that I wanted to share with all of our fellow Americans.
So you refer to the images on social media on Memorial Day. The Old Guard has a variety of uniforms, whether they be dress uniforms, historic uniforms, but very rarely are they wearing combat fatigues. And I think the pictures you're referring to are Washington, D.C. was subject to a tornado warning the Thursday before Memorial Day. Would you like to go into a little bit more about those images that we saw?
Sure, Jim. The Thursday before Memorial Day, going back almost eight decades now, has been known as Flags In at Arlington National Cemetery. The Old Guard will take off its ceremonial dress blue uniforms as funerals begin to conclude at the end of the day, and they will put on their combat fatigues. It's the only occasion of the year in which Old Guard soldiers wear combat fatigues into the cemetery because they are conducting what is really a massive military operation to put almost 245,000 flags at every single gravesite inside of Arlington. You'll see soldiers marching in with rucksacks and assault packs on their back filled with those little flags, large tactical trucks with flatbeds or stacked with flags. Trucks are driving in with water buffaloes full of water to keep the soldiers hydrated during what can be some pretty hot weather. And last Thursday, they endured what was a pretty violent rainstorm. In fact, it was so violent, I talked to the regimental commander, Jim Tewitt, later that night, and he said that they ended up having to put down their colors, which are on large flagstaff, tipped by metal spears, and their radios, which are obviously metal, under trees, and go squat in the middle of some of the open sections of the cemetery to avoid the lightning. But they didn't leave, and they didn't give up. They continued on as soon as the lightning passed, and they did, in fact, place a flag at every single headstone throughout the cemetery. You may have also seen the tomb guards placing flags at the tomb and the three crypts adjacent to the tomb as well in that driving rainstorm. It's just one example of the tireless devotion that the Old Guard shows to our fallen heroes on our behalf as a nation.
Right. And you know, for many decades, they've been the guardians of Arlington National Cemetery. And, you know, whether you're an Arkansan or Ohioan or, you know, a tourist from anywhere in the world, you know, you tend to go to Arlington Cemetery during the daylight hours. But the Old Guard is a constant presence there.
Yes. So the Old Guard is stationed at Fort Myer, which some of your Northern Virginia or Capital Region listeners may know is adjacent to the cemetery. There's only probably a 4 foot high, maybe 3 foot high stone wall that separates the cemetery from Fort Myer, and it wraps around the western and northern edge of the cemetery. Both the cemetery and Fort Myer are part of the old Arlington plantation that was owned by Robert E. Lee's wife and father. So it's kind of, they have that in common. And the Old Guard is on duty every single day at Fort Myer, and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier Platoon, of course, is on duty 24 hours around the clock every single day since 1937 inside the cemetery at the tomb and their underground quarters underneath the amphitheater. So there's really no rest for the old guard. And they've been performing that mission for 71 straight years since 1948 when they became the Army's official ceremonial unit and escort to the president.
You were selected, as I recall from in the book, at a sort of interesting time for the military. The Army was worn thin with the global war on terror. You had served abroad in the global war on terror. You ended up getting selected to the old guard. How? Because it's typically something you have to apply for.
The old guard has some of the Army's highest eligibility standards, much higher than a normal unit because of the sensitivity and the prominence of the mission. So the old guard, like any infantry regiment, is made up primarily of young privates. Those privates are recruited at basic training at Fort Benning from the rest of the infantry classes, but they have to meet very strict standards, certain height and weight standards, physical fitness standards, high test scores on the Army's general intelligence tests, no blemishes on their character or any kind of legal troubles. And then officers and NCOs have to typically apply, and they have additional requirements. Officers in particular have to be Ranger qualified and airborne qualified. They need to perform the job for which they're applying proficiently in another regiment. In general, it's a very long and complicated application process. But as you suggest, Jim, as I write in Sacred Duty, that wasn't the case for me. 2006, the Army was strained. We didn't have enough personnel for all the missions our nation had given us. And I opened my email one day in Iraq, and I got noticed I was assigned to the old guard, which was strange to me because I hadn't submitted an application. So I called the adjutant from the call trailer that night, the personnel officer, and I told him about this and asked him what had happened. And he said that we just hand-selected six new lieutenants and captains for the old guard. Usually in the Army, when you've been hand-selected for something, it means that you've done a good job, you're being given more responsibility or promotion. So I was curious how I got hand-selected. And he said, well, we searched the infantry officer personnel records for all those criteria I just mentioned, and then chose six of you. It's like, well, there must have been a lot more than six. I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a couple hundred. And I said, wow, a couple hundred. How did you choose just six of us? Which I was sure was going to mean that I'd done such an outstanding job leading my men in combat in Iraq, the Army was sending me to this prominent role. And said, we just rank ordered you all by height and chose the six tallest ones.
What is the importance of height?
So the height and weight standards are strict, 5'10 to 6'4. They can be honored in the breach, usually upward. I'm 6'5. One of the six was 6'7. But the Army wants to present a strong, soldierly appearance for all of the troops who are honoring our fallen heroes or performing ceremonies at the Pentagon or the White House for foreign heads of state or chiefs of defense or ministers of defense. And that's why they have those strict height and weight and physical fitness standards, because they want a soldier who's going to present a good, strong, soldierly appearance in uniform. As I mentioned in Sacred Duty, Jim Mattis came out once while he was Secretary of Defense to speak to the ceremonial officer in charge of a honor cordon at an arrival ceremony at the Pentagon. And he said, you guys look good today. You look intimidating. That's what we're going for. Because you want all those foreign leaders to recognize that this is the very best our nation has to present. That's what the Army is, and that's the kind of soldiers they want to be on the marks in those very prominent and very sensitive roles.
Is that unique in a way, offering the best standards? I know you write about no-fail, zero-defect funerals because, I mean, making no mistake, the old guard has a business of providing respectable burials for our war dead. It doesn't matter if you're in the Marines, it doesn't matter if you're in the Air Force and whatnot. You guys, your old unit does it all.
To my knowledge, the old guard is the only regiment that has those kinds of strict physical standards. Mm-hmm. If you've had the good fortune to get to know members of the special operations community, as I have, Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, Delta Force operators, and so forth, you'll know that some of them can be, the size of heavyweight boxer, 6'3" and 240 pounds, but others can be the size of world-class marathoners, 5'6" and very wiry. To my knowledge, the old guard is the only regiment that has those kind of strict physical standards. The other four services do have their own ceremonial units, and those units perform funerals for their war dead, and they participate with the Old Guard in joint armed forces ceremonies at places like the White House. They're just much smaller than the Army is, because the Army has always been by far our largest service, and in particular the largest service in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. So to give you a sense of scale, Jim, as I mentioned in Sacred Duty, the Old Guard has about 1,500 soldiers. The other four services, ceremonial units combined, only make up about 600 or 700 personnel.
And it's not just being the defenders of Arlington. There's a huge presence at the Dover Air Force Base in Delaware.
That is true. Dover Air Force Base has been the port mortuary of entry for several decades for personnel who were killed overseas, unfortunately. But since 2003, the Army has assigned the Old Guard, the subject matter experts in memorial affairs, to perform what's known as the dignified transfer of remains. As I write in Sacred Duty, the regimental commander last year was the first soldier to perform one of those missions in 2003 on a previous stint at the Old Guard when he was a company commander. He still has the mission order with his handwritten notes on it. That mission, unfortunately, had expanded by the time I arrived at the Old Guard in 2007 at the beginnings of the surge, so much so that we simply had a duty roster for the lieutenants and the captains in the regiment where you were assigned each month three or four nights of duty for Dover missions. And unfortunately, for the first many months I was at the Old Guard, if you had duty at Dover, it meant that you were going to perform duty at Dover. I can't recall any night in which we didn't have a dignified transfer of remains at the height of the surge. And the first mission I performed was unforgettable. You know, I took a six-man casket team and a general officer as an escort on a Black Hawk helicopter from Washington up to Dover Air Force Base. And that aircraft landed from Ramstein Air Base in Germany. And as the officer in charge, I was the first soldier on board with a few young airmen. And I made it past the rest of the cargo and got to the center of the cargo hold, and there I saw three flag-draped cases that contained the remains of my fallen comrades who'd been killed just a few hours earlier overseas, and I was the one to carry them off the aircraft. And it's a poignant reminder of the sacrifice that some Americans have to make so that we can live in freedom and safety. As I said, in Sacred Duty, I performed that mission a few dozen times, all hours of the day, sometimes with just one case, some once with as many as 19 cases. It did, thankfully, decline in frequency by the time I left the Old Guard in the summer of 2008 for Afghanistan. In fact, it was unlikely that you would have Dover duty on one of your assigned duty days because the surge had succeeded to such an extent over the previous year. But it still continues to this day, as I write in Sacred Duty. They still have an occasional Dover mission each month. And it's still a very tough duty for those soldiers, but they perform it with the same dedication and devotion and commitment to excellence and perfection that they show in Arlington National Cemetery as well.
And most of those who have sacrificed their lives for our country are buried in Section 60 if they choose, you know, if they or their families have opted that they be buried at Arlington. Would you mind sharing with us what that means to you?
Yeah, Section 60 is sometimes called the saddest acre in America. It's the section of the cemetery where cemetery leaders decided in 2002 to lay to rest the fallen heroes from the war in Afghanistan and soon the war in Iraq. It's where we performed, you know, 2 to 5 active duty funerals a week at the height of the surge in the middle of 2007. And it's just very different from any other section in the cemetery, Jim. As I write in Sacred Duty, many of these sections of the cemetery closed, for all intents and purposes, decades or even more than a century ago. The sections up at the top of the hill, behind the amphitheater, behind the Arlington House near Fort Myer, were filled, you know, in the 19th century. So people go there. You know, there are many interesting historical facts there, you know, and people go to visit their ancestors. But in Section 60, especially on Memorial Day weekend this weekend, it's really a living testament. You can see dozens, if not hundreds, of people there at any time. My wife and I took our boys there on Sunday to visit the gravesite of an airman, Mark Stratton, with whom I had served in Afghanistan, who had died 10 years previously. we met with the Corrier family, whose son, Ryan Corrier, had died in 2012. And it's a family we've gotten to know over the last 4 or 5 years as we go and visit some of the people and the families that we've met, that either I served with or that we've met in recent years. And just it is a very, like I said, a moving, living tribute to all those who have laid down their life over the last 17 years. It is terribly sad, I grant you that. But rather than the saddest acre in America, I prefer to think of it as the noblest acre in America.
I was going to ask you, correct me if I'm wrong on his rank, Lieutenant Colonel Stratton. I saw that you had posted a picture of his headstone, and I figured that you knew him and you had served with him. Are there... In previous interviews I had read and listened to that you had done, you said that you'd conducted a couple hundred of these over the course of your time with the Old Guard in various fashions. How many of the folks who are buried at Arlington or that you were part of their dignified processing did you know personally?
Jim, I don't think that I knew anyone personally whom we laid to rest. There is something of a distance kept between the Old Guard and the families. That's in part just as an administrative practicality. The cemetery staff are very professional, but they work very hard. And to try to compile full biographical information and obituaries could be potentially overwhelming to them. But it's also as a purposeful way to ensure that the Old Guard soldiers are performing their role in those missions, which is to honor. It's not to grieve. We always grieve the loss, especially of those who had been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan just a few days earlier. But we train very hard to maintain our composure at all occasions, even when presenting a folded flag to a wife or a parent who just lost a husband or wife or a son or daughter overseas. Because we don't, as I said earlier, we don't want to do anything that would mar that final moment of honor for the family. So I can't say that I recall performing funerals for anyone that I would have known. I have since, like I said, met many people whose loved ones are buried in Arlington, and I knew Colonel Stratton. I've since met his family at Dover in particular. There's no identifying information on the external part of the transfer case. It's all kept inside the transfer case in waterproof pouches. And that's very much by design, because those remains, when they leave the battlefield, once the unit transfers it over to the mortuary collection point, will pass through many hands. It will never be alone, as fallen heroes are always escorted by some service member, whether it's an official escort or an aircrew out of Afghanistan or Iraq or an aircrew out of Germany. But because it goes through so many different stages of escort, they never know when someone who knew that deceased soldier might recognize the name if it was on the external part of the case. They keep it all internal. The last Dover mission I performed had a flag with a small smudge on it from the cargo straps, which is common. Normally, we had removed that flag and discard it, replace it with a new flag. But that night, I asked the casket team to fold the flag for me, knowing it was my last Dover mission, so I could keep it. And today, it sits in a shadow box in my Senate office. I don't know whose case it adorned, but I view it as a testament to all those whom I carried back to their home soil at Dover Air Force Base and all those who have laid down their life in defense of our nation over the last 18 years.
One of the things I found personally fascinating was the concept of fallouts in the dedication to perfection and making sure that the family members, be they spouses, siblings, children, parents, or whatnot, this is sort of like one of their last official touches with the U.S. government and with the military that the deceased served for. In this dedication of perfection, there are folks who hide behind trees, they hide behind bushes. Would you mind kind of telling our listeners a little bit about the concept of fallouts? Because, I mean, it's a great level of granular, meticulous detail that I don't think a lot of people would ever think about.
One of the sergeant majors at the Old Guard on his first tour there, sergeant major, for those who didn't serve in the military, is the senior enlisted soldier in a battalion or any echelon above. Told me, he said, you know, I got here, I fall out, no big deal. If someone falls out of a formation, you take them to the back, you get them some water, you know, you chew them out the next day and maybe do some corrective PT and you move out. So I didn't realize it was such a significant emotional event. And that's because, as you say, you know, you don't want to do anything that would mar that moment for the family in Arlington National Cemetery, or for that moment that would reflect badly on the Old Guard in the United States Army at a ceremony on the south lawn of the White House, or the river lawn entrance to the Pentagon, in front of a foreign dignitary. So the Old Guard trained at great length to ensure that its soldiers were prepared to stand in formation for a very long time. For instance, the officer test when I was there required me to stand at attention for 75 minutes without moving a muscle. Some of my friends at the time would say, well, how can it be that hard? You're just standing there. I would invite all of your listeners, if they think that, just to try to stand in one position without moving for more than a couple moments, and you realize that we rarely do that, and it can be very hard on your ankles, your knees, your hips, your back, but you've got to train. It's just like any other kind of training discipline in the military or in life, for that matter. And no soldier would go on the marks in the cemetery or in a ceremony until they had passed those standing proficiency tests. And then in the cemetery, especially if you were on funeral duty for a week, it was a constant reminder to our soldiers when we released at the end of the day, go home, no more PT, eat a square meal, hydrate well, don't drink alcohol or don't drink too much alcohol, and get a good night's sleep. You got another day of funerals tomorrow. So it was something that was constantly on our mind. Now, as you say, sometimes you can't help it. You know, in July and August, when it's 97 degrees and 100% humidity and soldiers are performing 6 or 7 funerals a day in heavy wool uniforms, at some point, fallout is inevitable. So as part of every funeral, part of every ceremony, there are personnel is designed just to deal with that contingency. So as you put it, the person hiding behind a tree, somewhat in undignified fashion, but the real name is the supernumerary, which is Latin for one above the number. That's a soldier who is in the same uniform. He's already got his ceremonial belt over his coat. He's already got his white gloves on and his hat on. And he literally will hide behind a tree or a bush or anywhere else out of sight of the family in the event that there is a fallout. Number one, I was standing at attention in front of my troops facing the gravesite about 50 yards away. And the last man in the front rank fell out. It was like a tree that had been cut. He just fell straight forward and face planted in the ground. No one moved. We'd been trained to prepare for the contingency. The assistant non-commissioned officer in charge walked over in a military fashion and put his hand under his belt and dragged that soldier off of the formation. Meanwhile, the supernumerary walked out onto the formation in a military fashion and picked up the rifle and fell back into position where the previous soldier had been. So even when you do have those moments, you still end up exactly the way you started. Now, as it turns out, this soldier had listened to us. He hadn't done anything inappropriate the previous night in terms of staying out late or drinking too much, but he was coming down with the beginning elements of an illness, and he didn't go to sick call that day because he didn't want to leave his buddies hanging out in the cemetery. So that was good initiative, but bad judgment on his part.
You obviously wrote this book recently after you were elected to the Senate. And I think a lot of people who have not worked in the Senate or do not know senators wonder, how does a sitting U.S. senator make the time to kind of shadow the aspects of the operation that I assume that you didn't do every single job in the Old Guard when you were with them? Then you wanted to kind of refresh these sorts of things in your mind for the purpose of kind of writing this history book. Was it like recess weeks, or how did you find the time to do this?
Yeah, it was very far from performing all of the missions in the Old Guard. During my time there, the Old Guard was smaller. One of our companies was deployed overseas, so we really performed funerals in Charlie Company almost every week. We either had primary or secondary responsibility, which meant we were doing funerals almost every week for 16 months. On occasion, we would get a break, but a break for us meant we were performing in ceremonies, or maybe we would go down I-95 an hour to Fort AP Hill and get some basic tactical training for our troops. I never commanded the drill team, which is one of the Army or one of the military's premier precision drill teams. I certainly never played a fife or drum in the Fife and Drum Corps, which is maybe the most educated unit in the Army. Almost every soldier there has a bachelor's. Many of them have masters in music, and some of them even have doctorates from places like Juilliard and Berkeley. I didn't ride horses in the caisson platoon. I didn't guard the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier with that platoon. So some of the book I can write about from firsthand experience, and some of it is my experience, but a lot of it is just about how the Old Guard works. But others, I had to go and report on everything that happened. So I spent many late nights, for instance, at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. There working around the clock, so it was easy to meet with them after votes during the week. Other elements, I would go interview them on Mondays before votes, or maybe Thursdays after votes, or Fridays if we didn't have votes. There was on occasion when I was in Washington for recess period, you know, I wanted to chronicle what the Old Guard did on the 4th of July, so I was there last 4th of July with the Old Guard at the National Archives. I also took that week as an occasion to go back to Dover Air Force Base for the first time in 10 years to receive a tour and a briefing about what happens there. And then, you know, the writing would happen once we put the boys to bed and on the weekends. So it was a lot of work, but it was very much a labor of love. And I will say that I had a lot more fun with soldiers in 2018 than I had with politicians.
At a time right now where everything's about politics, every book's political and everything needs to be about politics, that it's easy to forget Memorial Day. It's often an overlooked holiday. Are there any writings that inspired, you know, your research for this book or sorts of things? I mean, because it just couldn't all have been your experience in going to Arlington and spending time with members of your fellow old unit. Are there books that inspired you that listeners that should read or listen to in an audiobook?
If you want to know a very detailed history of the cemetery in which the Old Guard appears in passing, I would recommend Robert Poole's book called Hallowed Ground. It's about 10 years old. It's a very, very detailed history of the cemetery itself and how it grew over time, which has always been a point of controversy as it remains today. I have found, especially when I was writing about the history of the Old Guard and the history of the cemetery and for Sacred Duty, that many of the speeches for events like Memorial Day, or in particular the Memorial Day occasions, or the Veterans Day or Memorial Day, where the unknown soldiers were being laid to rest, were particularly moving. So you might consider Warren Harding's eulogy in 1921, one of the very first presidential addresses to be heard over radio, Dwight Eisenhower's remarks when they interred both the World War II and the Korean War unknown in 1958. And I particularly thought Ronald Reagan was fantastic in 1984 when they interred the Vietnam unknown. As I write in Sacred Duty, that's a much longer and more complicated story with the Vietnam unknown, who was 14 years later was disinterred and identified as Lieutenant Michael Blassie, and now rests in Jefferson Barracks National Cemetery outside St. Louis, where he grew up. But I think Ronald Reagan put it very well. Whether we knew him as an unknown or we now know him as Lieutenant Blassie, he simply said that this American soldier may not need us, but we surely need him. And I think that captures very nicely what the unknowns mean for us as a nation, whatever our viewpoints or political party, and really what Arlington means for us as a nation, whatever our viewpoints or political party.
I think one of the most impactful funerals that you had written and have talked about that you participate in was the EZ-40 helicopter funeral. Sort of, I mean, all the people were known, but there was a sorting out where it took a little while for the military to kind of sort out who was where, and it was a group burial.
Every funeral is pursued to the same standard of perfection, whether it's the state funeral of George H.W. Bush or the funeral of the humble private who served in the Korean War and went on to live many years peacefully and happily in the United States. That doesn't mean every funeral is the same by any means. The funeral for EZ-40 certainly stands out for me, and I think for most people who performed it, it was the largest funeral any of us could remember. There were 12 passengers and crew of EZ-40, a Black Hawk helicopter, that was shot down outside Baghdad in January of 2007. And as you say, the Army took many months to identify 12 remains to allow for individual burials for their loved ones, in both in Arlington, but other cemeteries around the country. Yet after all that effort, there still were some commingled, unidentifiable remains from that crash and the fire. And under those conditions, the Army custom was to have a group burial. So we had a group burial for all 12 of those soldiers. It was the largest funeral by far that any of us could remember. You know, there were 12 flag bearers, of which I was one, standing at the head of the casket to present those flags after touching them to the casket to the next families, next of kin. The procession went back to hundreds of cars, and there were hundreds and hundreds of mourners, many four-star generals. It really does stand out. And in my memory and to my knowledge, there probably hasn't been a funeral that big since then either. You know, there's a major media contingent. It was featured on NBC Nightly News. And I think it was a very poignant moment to show in kind of a very large setting what the old guard does and why they do it. But as you say, there aren't many unknown soldiers left today. There are unidentifiable remains or commingled remains. And even then, the old guard and our military more broadly pays the greatest respect to those remains to make sure that they are properly cared for and handled in a respectful fashion.
Senator Cotton, thanks so much for making the time to join us today to talk about your book, Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery.
Jim, thanks so much for your interest in Sacred Duty.
We appreciate you making the time. And if you're listening, you can find the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other booksellers by you. This has been the Bulwark Podcast, and we'll be back tomorrow.